Hello, everybody. Today on the call, we have Chris Brogan, co-author of the best-selling book Trust Agents and president of New Marketing Labs, a new media marketing agency. Chris, I have you on this call today because when I think about how to become a trusted authority in the niche, your name is the first to come to mind. And I know you spent a lot of time not only learning about trust and influence, but also walking the talk. With over 150,000 Twitter followers and a solid reputation for building meaningful business relationships online, I know we have a lot to learn on today's call. So everyone who's listening, please get ready to take some good notes. Chris, could you take a quick moment and introduce yourself to any listeners who may not already know you?
Well, sure. Hi, everybody. My name is Chris Brogan. I am president of New Marketing Labs, which is, as Dave said, a new media marketing agency where we work with pretty much big companies to figure out how to use all these social media tools to drive revenue and value. And I also just started a company called Human Business Works, which is the exact opposite of the spectrum, where I do education and instruction for very small companies from 1 to 7 people. In how to expand and improve their business, not just marketing, but anything that they're going to need to set up their business. So I guess that's me. I come from a enterprise telecom background. I have no marketing background in my past. I'm an absolute novice when it comes to the official world of marketing. I just accidentally do it reasonably well.
Yeah, well, I would say a little more than reasonably. I aspire to have some of the command you do over speaking gigs. That's I got to tell you, you're definitely one of the people I look to in that area. So, Chris, while a lot of businesses focus on social media platforms like blogs, Twitter, and Facebook as just purely selling tools, and I know I often see you focusing more on these spaces as really like opportunities to build a strong, trusted relationship with people long before any selling takes place. So I really want to talk to you about some of the concepts you cover on your blog and also in the book Trust Agents. The first thing I'd like to talk about is something that you speak to often. It's a concept called social capital. Can you tell us what you mean by that and why that's important?
Sure. So part of the genesis of the book Trust Agents with Julian Smith and with myself was this whole idea of social capital, which was the idea that there were more than one kind of currency going on. And in that experience, what I was finding was that we understand the difference in exchange between time and money. If I have a little bit of extra money and if I don't have much time, I can pay somebody to do my laundry, say. Like the other day I had groceries delivered to my house because it was worth the extra $6 for me to use that time for myself and have groceries show up at my door. What we started to realize, though, is that there's other currency, like attention currency and social capital currency. And these are the things that we thought were interesting because this is where marketers don't usually and business people don't usually take their time and work things through. Meaning, you can spend money to get attention. We call it advertising. But it's just a brief moment of attention. It's a brief moment of awareness, actually. What you have a harder time doing is transferring money into social capital, meaning reputation and trust and the fact that there's some value going to be exchanged. That's the real gold. Because if you think about it, if you're sitting there and a commercial goes by and says, you should drink this beer, you may or may not react. If I say I am drinking probably the best beer I've ever had in my life and you've known me for a few years and you know that I'm not selling that beer for that company, you go, huh, I think I shall buy this beer. If I say I've just taken a job representing this beer because I'm so passionate about this beer, then you know, wow, he's totally into this. He's actually going to try to help them build his business. This to me is kind of like the seeds of social capital and why there's a benefit to it over the other ways that we can earn our way to business.
Yeah, I think it's interesting that you mentioned that because I've never called it social capital, but I have always used that kind of tactic as a way to compensate for maybe some beginner marketing skills of my own. Like, you know, some people say like, hey, you know, you're a really good copywriter. I'm like, no, I'm not. I just make friends. And then then the copy can be not as strong and people will still want to buy. So I think that for everyone listening here, you really take note of what Chris said there about, you know, when he said he didn't have marketing background in the past, like specific official marketing background. When you can build up that trust with people and that level of genuineness and connection, then I always say, like, I say, you know, trust covers over a multitude of marketing sins. You know, you can be not good at a lot of other things and just okay at them. But if you have a strong connection with people, it's like you're suddenly the best marketer in the world when it comes to actually converting them as customers and bringing them in. So I'm glad you mentioned that. One other thing that I was really interested in that you've talked about before is becoming a trusted authority even in a market that's saturated with other authority figures by doing something called making your own game. Can you talk to us a little bit about how that works?
Sure. So the whole idea of making your own game is being able to sort of stand out. It's differentiation is one way to look at it, but that's only part of it. One of the examples that Julian and I like to use is the idea that imagine that you decide you want to do a circus, but you decide that circuses are very low margin. There's not a lot of money in them. You decide that it's kind of dopey to have all of the, you know, popcorn and all that, and it's just a waste. So you take away all the popcorn, and then you say, you know what? Animals are expensive, and they cost a lot of money to manage and maintain, and they're tricky. I mean, animals just aren't easy to deal with. Let's take those away too. Then you work on the idea of, well, you know, the ticket for a circus is like $20. I think we should make it like $200. We'll take away five more things, and we'll add two things, and then we'll make the tickets like $200 each. And then you have Cirque du Soleil. And before anybody thought of Cirque du Soleil, of course, if you'd said to somebody in the circus business, hey, I think I'd like to make a really expensive circus with no animals, they would give you the jacket with the sleeves on the back. And that's really the essence of making your own game. Making your own game is seeing an opportunity that wasn't there or seeing a new way to take on an opportunity. You know, one of my favorite examples recently, Dave, this is the most ridiculous thing in the world. Artisanal pencil sharpening. Artisanalpencilsharpening.com. I'm not kidding. Take a look at it. Have your audience take a look at it. This guy set up a website, and he's dead serious at being funny. He's made a website offering pencil sharpening. And he will send you a fully, perfectly, professionally hand-sharpened number two pencil for $12.95, and it comes with like a certificate of authenticity and all this kind of stuff. And it is totally not a joke. Like, I mean, he did it as a joke, but he's making a full-on business sharpening pencils.
It reminds me of the guy who started that origami boulder site where he just crunched up a piece of paper. That was his origami boulder, and he was selling those for $10 a piece. But it's interesting that you mentioned the Cirque du Soleil because you don't have to have like a gimmicky thing to make this happen. And one of the things I thought was really interesting about making your own game was about actually disconnecting from the rules that other people have, because I think you also said make your own rules, and saying that, you know, just because everybody is used to business being done in a certain way does not mean that it has to be done that way. You can totally do something innovative.
Dave, let me talk about that too. You know, another example that we used in our book was about Perez Hilton. It's an interesting example. If you'd said this fat, strange gay man wanted to break into entertainment marketing and entertainment coverage, celebrity gossip and that sort of a thing, and that he went to places like People Magazine and they said, oh, no way. And he went to places like Star Magazine and they said, you're not good enough for us. And then he opens up a blog and kicks all their butts. Suddenly he's getting scoops, he's getting exclusive interviews, and Perez Hilton is born out of this experience. Everyone would have laughed at you. I mean, that's the thing about making your own game. Almost every single time someone makes their own game, it starts with, that's the stupidest thing I ever heard. And, but what the difference is, you know, make sure you treat people well, make sure you build a huge network, make sure that you, build kind of personal deep relationships. One of the criticisms I might give to people who kind of jump into, the space of say, internet marketing and whatnot, sometimes they're just so hungry to get the money because of something going on in their life. Maybe they're not getting their bills met, or maybe they're just so sick of their job or whatever, that they try to cut a lot of corners and take a lot of shortcuts on the relationship building side of things. Partly also because if they weren't a digital native, if they weren't born on computers like I was, they don't realize as tightly and intimately that the things you do online actually do relate to a human on the other side of the line. And so I guess one of the things that seems like it might be frivolous or seems like something that you wouldn't necessarily want to spend your time on out of the gate is one of the most important things to me, which is the relationship building stuff.
Mm-hmm. And to speak a little more about to the make your own game, I know this is something that I think about a lot because when we look at our ability to build our businesses and our ability to network and make relationships, a lot of times we have these limiting factors in our mind, like, well, I can't do this. Like, for example, it would be like, well, I can't start a circus. I don't know anything about animals. And if you actually say, well, what if I could do what I wanted to do and make it 10 times more successful and like take all the hassle out of it, what would it have to look like? And because I know a lot of people might be intimidated about the idea of making their own game because it's like, well, I can't just go out there and change the rules and expect everybody to follow. But if you step back and you say, listen, how can I make something a lot more valuable and not have to do all the stuff everybody else is doing, then you can just completely jump to the front and come up with ideas. It's actually very creative. If you're stuck with creative ideas and you just step back and say, you know, what, like the MacGyver approach, you know, if all I had was a stick of chewing gum and a paperclip, you know, how could I, you know, get this plane working or something like that. And it's very interesting how just asking those questions helps you create those rules. Because if you look at how a lot of people make their own game, a lot of times it's just because they said, you know what, I just totally don't want to do this thing that everybody does. And you get something like a Southwest Airlines that just says, yeah, forget it. No seating. You know, just come in and do what you want or something like that. And while we're on the topic of kind of jumping ahead, I know that the two interesting things that you talk about often are gatekeepers and gate jumpers. And I think that our audience could really benefit by knowing a little more about what those mean and what that means to building, you know, trust and building your business. Can you speak to that a bit?
Well, sure. So, for example, in the world of public relations, it used to be this thing like we all just wanted to get our stuff into the Wall Street Journal, say, or the New York Times. And that's what we needed. And if we got that, we'd have everything. Or we'd want to publish a book, we'd have to wait around until some publisher thought that was a great idea, or et cetera. So these are media making examples. And that was gatekeeping. People would say, well, you know, there's one reason or another we're not going to let you have access to this, or we just don't think that story is worthy of the Times, whatever. Gate jumping is saying, I don't even need that stuff to do what I'm doing. So one of the biggest gate jumpers ever was Oprah Winfrey. I mean, she very recently said, you know, I don't think I need my giant mainstream TV network. I think I'm just going to make my own. I'm okay now, thanks. And I mean, she did use the mainstream to get to where she was because it was the only tool set she had at the time. But there's a lot of us out there who are just deciding to gate jump. One of the reasons I got into blogging when I started back in 98 was I was writing fictional stories, short stories, and I couldn't get them published anywhere. And so I started writing them and publishing them on my own blog. And I said, well, there you go. I'm out. And it was not lucrative, and it was not very rewarding right away. But I was out there, and that grew my blog, and that grew my attention. And the funny thing is, maybe 99%, without much exaggeration, of the places that I was trying to get published in are all out of business, and I'm on top of the world. So I did it just by deciding that I had the tools that I could jump past everybody else and get to where I needed to go.
Mm-hmm. And I think it's important that everyone listening who wants to do something like that kind of surrounds themselves with people who are doing those kind of things, because if you go it alone, you kind of think you can't do something like that, or there's a lot of internal resistance. But the more people you expose yourself to that are doing that kind of thing, that are breaking the rules and making their own rules, the more it kind of inspires you to do the same thing. Now, one thing that is really important, I know, about creating trust with your audience is not being, you know, so much that this big guru on a high horse who's totally separate and totally disparate from where their audience is, but instead actually kind of comes down into the audience and really establishes that strong rapport that you call kind of like the one of us factor, where you help your audience understand that you can relate to them, and because of that, you can be fully trusted by them. How specifically do you make that kind of relationship happen?
Well, so first and foremost, I think that it's really tricky. I think that you know, for example, there's a lot of people out there that think that branding involves putting something in their name and saying, you know, I'm going to call myself blah, blah, the blah, blah. And I'm just not down with that, to quote Sir Mix-a-Lot. I think that one of the problems with that kind of thing is that, one is, it sticks you in a hole. I mean, if Seth Godin was the permission marketing guy, then he would not have been also the purple cow guy and the small is the new big guy and the linchpin guy. Two is that the you know, that should start to come to you insofar as that you've sort of built your relationship, you've sort of, people start to know what you're good for and what you can deliver, etc. You know, one example from back in the day was Christopher Penn doing the Financial Aid podcast. The way he built relationships was he was putting out really great information pertaining to financial aid that and or things that students would need. So on one side, he was speaking to the parents of students who have the money. On the other side, he was speaking to the students who were looking for ways to save what money they had and looking for ways to kind of navigate college better. Students were really getting into his podcast for the ways that he was helping them out and passing it to the parents. Parents were really getting into the fact that they were giving them tons of good advice. And then Chris got in with pretty much every financial aid office inside of every high school, helping people, guidance counselors. I couldn't think of the word guidance counselor, helping people get ready to go to college. And then he had the win. Basically, he had the marketplace. And he was the one guy doing this kind of marketing where he was just being helpful all the time, as opposed to everybody else saying, sign now, get a loan, get a loan. We buy from people we like, Dave. It is a really basic, several thousand-year-old truth. We buy from people we like. So why wouldn't we spend time working on that currency? Why wouldn't we spend some time working on building relationships and doing what we say in the book is be there before the sale?
Mm-hmm. Now, one thing that I know that some of our listeners are experiencing, because actually some of them have talked to me about this, is that they have gotten good at what they do, and they're already, you know, somewhat of an authority in their niche or somewhat of an authority in the audience that they have. And sometimes they feel like because of the level of success and the level of experience that they have, that they're kind of far away from a lot of where their audience is, and they have a hard time connecting with them and actually doing the one of us thing. So for somebody who it's almost like they haven't been one of them for quite a while, how can they begin to put something into place that allows them to connect with their audience, like when they might have, you know, forgotten what it's like to be in their shoes?
See, that's a good question. Thanks for restating it. It's tricky because I think that it's always the challenge. As I've watched other people kind of come up their ranks, so to speak, in the blogging world, I've seen them get too big for their britches sometimes. And I've seen them, pride goeth before the fall is a really awesome quote because of how repetitively reusable it is. I see people frequently fall back under the blade because they just run into this problem of not remembering their roots. I think one way is to really, you know, who did this well was Bono. And you'll never hear me say that ever again in my life in any other context. So absorb it now, Dave Navarro listeners. What Bono did really well is he shared his stage. And all the way through his career, as he was coming up and as he was a nobody, he remembered who gave him breaks and he remembered who did good stuff for him. But then he also shared his stage, both with kind of acts who were legendary but starting to get forgotten, but most especially with acts that were going vertical and coming up. Liz Strauss, who's from Chicago, has this really great phrase that I love to quote all the time, little bloggers grow up. And that's really how I built my relationships, was I spent my time working with the kinds of people who were up and coming and not yet a voice. And that helped me and keeps helping me stay really true to my roots. So hopefully that's the kind of answer you're looking for. But I guess you can fall away from where you came from. I mean, you have to be just Jenny from the block. Otherwise, you're going to run into trouble.
Right. Do you recommend that people who have, you know, the means to do so kind of get like assistants or team members to help with that, to manage that, or to kind of be advocates to go out there and be kind of almost like an additional face to the business?
Hell yes. So that, it's a good question, Dave. Let me put it in huge, you know, relevant to me terms that hopefully will be useful to others. When I started Human Business Works, this is a second company on top of – I mean, I have too many jobs basically. I run a marketing company. I have 9 employees there, and they are thankfully pretty much a solid formed team now. So I'm kind of like the Don Draper. I get in a room, I smile a lot, and I go, and I think up an idea, and they all do all the hard stuff. So that team is running. My professional speaking gig is pretty much just me. I have an executive assistant that manages contract and flight details. And if I had to do that myself, I would be underwater because I fly so much. The new business, Human Business Works, I started right away by looking for a right-hand man. And I don't mean that sexist, you know, right-hand person. And I picked Rob Hatch, which was the guy that I know back from 8th grade, who I had been hanging out with, you know, occasionally. He was up in Maine where I'm from, and I'd visit his family and all that. And I didn't ever think I could lure him away from his company. But by hiring Rob, it's been a really interesting process for me because Rob has helped me slow down and realize that I need some processes, and that when I have these processes, then Rob can go find people to plug into different parts of my business and do it with me. So yes, the minute you can afford it, to have people help you stay on top of things is awesome. Inside of Third Tribe Marketing, we have somebody helping us as a community manager, and that helps us know which conversations need to be looked at, and it helps us know where we should be focusing our attention. If we didn't have that, sometimes we would see questions go unanswered, and somebody would be feeling a lot more frustrated because they would feel unseen. Mm-hmm. It's hard to see everyone. This is scaling is the hardest thing in the world. If you Google the phrase redrawing, I should be the number one for it. And I wrote a lot about the fact that, you know, there's a lot of things you have to reconsider once you scale in this new media business where everyone has more access to you.
So when, speaking of scaling, when people don't have as much access to you, I mean, I really appreciate the fact that you're making an entire hour block of time for me today. And I know that that's not something you do for everybody. And so I'm very grateful for that. But the thing is, everybody wants a piece of you because, you know, as you grow your business, everybody still wants the same access to you that they had when you were a smaller business where you had more time. How do you manage using other people as kind of almost like gatekeepers or assistants to help you do that without kind of turning off your audience and making them feel like, you know, you're too inaccessible?
Ah, so that is really the trick. And one of the ways, to me, it's just like right there in front of me, is I do still talk back and forth on places like Twitter. I do still make sure I connect with people. When they send an email, I try to do something personal back. And which reminds me, I have to write a note to dig into my contact form because there's some things I needed to answer. I do have a lot of personal touches that I do to try to make sure that people are getting heard and know that I'm there as well. I think you can't get away from that. You know, I make time when I go to conferences, and it gets a little harder because of just commitments to other things and other meetings and whatnot. I still make as much effort as I can to stay on the floor and spend time with people in the hallways and things like that because I think that's one of my little dividing factors, Dave. I think that one of the ways that people get to feel what they feel about me is that I'm in their face. I'm there. They can come and shake hands with me. They can see me make dumb jokes. They can realize that, you know, I don't just talk about marketing. I talk about superheroes and underpants and things like that. You know, in the affiliate marketing space, one of the guys who does this, I think, really well, who doesn't get nearly as much credit as he deserves for it, is John Chow. John Chow, in a way, like when you go to his website and everything, you're just like, holy cow, it's like going to NASCAR. There's, you know, I'm afraid to move my mouse because I'm sure I bought something.
Right.
He's kind of known for that. He's known for having like this like sort of unapologetic sight of sights that, you know, builds tons of money. But when you meet him, he's very personable. He loves filming him and his friends eating food in restaurants. And he's just a very personable guy. And so I just think that there's something to that. And I think there's a lot of value in staying out there and staying connected to the humanity. Otherwise, you're just a stuffed shirt.
Yeah, I know that as I grow my business and I have to deal with the limitations on my time, that's an important thing to me. And that's why I asked. I know a lot of people are thinking about that because your audience does get you where you are. And a lot of times, that especially bloggers, that interaction is constant and personal in the comments. And then there just reaches a time when you just can't quite do it. So I appreciate the answers that you've given me on that. One of the other things I wanted to talk about is this whole idea of raising up versus sucking up, which is something that you covered in Trust Agents, because it was the exact strategy that I used to build up my audience over the last 2 years, and I think it's just unbelievably effective. But I'd like to have you talk to our listeners about that and explain how you communicate that to people.
Well, so for example, it's amazing how many people just kind of look for the biggest guy on the block and make their entire relationship about trying to connect with that person. It seems like a really limiting kind of way to do it. If you basically are just going after the kind of big name, because the big name is used to being courted. The big name has a lot too many people asking for a lot too many things. I mean, I use paper in my office for the first time in a long time. I have this giant 3M Post-it papers, and then I put little yellow Post-it notes on top of those that say commitments. And so on the commitments is things I was stupid enough to say yes to. and, you know, write the foreword for this book, write a blurb for this book, you know, a lot of that. You know, for some reason, I seem to be the flavor of the day for putting a name on the front of a book somewhere. So when I look at all those, it kind of helps me realize that aspect of my business, of sort of connecting and doing all that sort of thing. At the same time, what I try to do is at every step and every turn, I try not to talk about the people who are the biggest, awesomest names in the business. I try to find who I think are the real stars. I look at people like Ed Shazaid on Twitter. I look at Glenda Watson Hyatt, who's the left thumb blogger. This is a woman who has basically only control of her left thumb and has wrote an entire book. So on days when people are like, yeah, you know, I'd like to write a book, but I'm busy, blah, blah, blah. This woman did it with a thumb, one thumb. So you suck. And so, I like to promote those kinds of people. It also falls into my idea of promoting other people 12 times as much as you promote yourself. Because I'll tell you, two things happen when you start promoting people who are up and coming. Like, for example, I wrote a post the other day, other day related to this recording, called Serving Suggestions, wherein which I promoted Drew Bennett, runs Ben Spark, and he was just offering up his services as a blog consultant. And I liked how he did it. I liked his page and what he set up. He's, of course, ecstatic that, you know, my big, super popular, successful blog, I point to him. I mean, I'm sure he's going to have enough business in the short term all of a sudden. So I think that I will now have a loyal person for life in somebody like Drew Bennett because I did him something like that. And I'm not looking for reciprocation because I think sometimes we accidentally try to seek out reciprocity. Mm-hmm. But I would say that instead what I'm looking for is I'm looking to do good turns for a lot of people because I want to build my army that way.
Right. And it's really interesting. I look at it as almost like a stewardship role in that, you know, when we're growing our businesses, we are looking for people to lend their trust to us. Because, you know, when you mention Drew, then what you're doing is you're actually imparting the trust of your audience over to them. You're implicitly endorsing them. It doesn't mean that trust funnels away from you. It just means that it almost copies over to that person. And for up-and-coming business, that is a huge thing. And I remember when I was growing, there were a few people who linked to me, and it was like, wow, when they linked to me, I got a huge influx of attention, a huge influx of business. And it's important to realize that as we grow, it's almost and I'm not telling people how to do their business or something from a moral standpoint, but I feel like it's almost like a responsibility to take the resource that we have and the influence that we have and to be a steward of it by sharing it with other people that we feel are deserving who just need – who are in a position where, you know, a link from you or a link from, you know, another large blog can just – completely change the scope of their business. And because this happened to me last year, I had like one major feature of me in a PDF that just kind of like put me like 12 months ahead in where I was. And it's amazing that when you do that for people, it also builds the trust of your audience too, because it does remind them that you are aware of what's going on the floor and in the trenches, and that you're not just hanging out with the A-listers or, you know, the people, whatever sphere there are, you know, people will always look at people as A-listers, even if they're quote unquote, like several levels down, as long as they're above you, they seem like they're A-listers instead of people. But I think that we all should, just not only from a moral standpoint, but also from a business standpoint, treat our influence as something to be stewarded, because it does create people who just absolutely love you, not because, you know, you have you've kind of bought their vote, so to speak, but because, you know, you're showing that it's not all about you. You know what I mean?
I do know what you mean. I think that I agree. I think that there's a situation. It's funny what you said. One of the things I wanted to go back on was when you talked about A-listers, because I think that it's a really funny thing, the whole A-lister thing. It was really prominent, I don't know, about 4 or 5 years ago. And I remember just, you know, that was always, for some reason, there was always this thing about the A-list, the B-list or whatever. And now I usually only hear it when people are complaining or, you know, saying they're sick of hearing from me or something, which is fine. But I think that it's in our guts to feel that sense of, yeah, but I'm not such and such. And I don't know where that comes from, but it does. I mean, we all have that thing, like, you know, oh, but I'm not him. That's never going to happen. I mean, it took me 8 years to get 100 readers. And the other day, someone made some kind of a comment about, man, I can't believe that somebody sent you such and such a product. Like, it's a really expensive product, blah, blah, blah. And I was like, right. But I mean, it wasn't like that showed up the first week I started blogging. This is somebody who has like, you know, a month and a quarter of blog posts up, and they're mostly posts pointing to other people's posts and, you know, adding a paragraph on them. And I'm like, wow, yeah, I'm so surprised they didn't send you something. I mean, we have that mistake of forgetting that it takes time to get where we get. And I think that, you know, to your point, you have to grow it.
Right. Yeah, somebody mentioned me on a blog the other day and said, oh, you know, it's like, well, Dave came out of nowhere overnight and knows everybody. And I was like, yeah, yeah, that overnight thing happened after about 12 to 18 months of work.
Okay, now you're just making me feel bad because it took me years to become an overnight success.
Well, I started later. I started when the road got easier. So, you know, you started way earlier than I did, and I was fortunate enough to be on the receiving end of a few people who, like I just mentioned, there's a reason I mentioned, like, you know, you need to be a steward of your stuff, because I wouldn't have gotten where I was without the trust of other people imparting it. And it's so important, I think, also to connect with other trusted people, because that trust, it rubs off on you. If there's any way you can do something or be involved in something that somebody, quote unquote, higher up on the ladder is doing, then it increases your profile and increases your exposure just by default. I mean, you could take that blogger who had, you know, one paragraph at the end of the post, and if they happened to be sitting on the couch with Oprah during an interview, even if they said nothing, there would be this amazing level of trust that imparts to them just psychologically. It's just something that people do. And I'm not saying that people should do that as kind of like a manipulative thing, but it's to, you know, it's to realize that if you don't go it alone and you really connect with other people, it can accelerate the level of trust that you build in your brand, because you get close to people. You know what I mean?
I totally know what you mean. I totally do. And I think it's one of those cases where the opportunity to me, Dave, in some ways it comes to the basics. Like, I really hope the people that are consuming this aren't like sitting there going, yeah, well, tell me something I don't know. Because I'll tell you the one truth that I get over and over and over again is that when people say that to me, I say, yeah, but are you doing it?
Uh-huh.
And the answer is almost always no, if they want to be honest. These things take time. I was reading one of my favorite books about business was Richard Branson, the newest one, Business Trip Bear. And I think that what I liked about it was he just had a really human-focused mindset for doing his business. And you can call him a lot of things now. You can look at him and be like, holy cow, he's a multi-billionaire. The dude owns an island, and he bought a space company. He's going to launch spaceships. You know, this is not normal crap. But he comes from, you know, guy who tried to do a record store after doing, you know, a newsletter business. I mean, he started in a newsletter, like a school newsletter or whatever. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, we just really have to keep our eyes on the fact that, you know, we grow from something.
Right. Now, I didn't know all that stuff until the other day when I read an article by Sonia Simone on Copyblogger about all the things that Richard Branson did that were just kind of, you know, out there and like why on earth would you do that kind of thing? But, you know, people have to realize that, you know, for anybody to get where they are, they have to churn through a lot of learning experiences. And actually, if you're transparent about your learning experiences to people, that also builds trust, because they see you growing and they see you maturing. And that's actually something that I did want to talk about as well, because when you use social media to gain exposure, you kind of open yourself up to a lot of criticism. And there are times that either upset customers, create a lot of negative publicity for you, or somebody, even if you didn't do anything wrong, sometimes people just, you know, take the opportunity to use a platform to complain. Or, you know, maybe sometimes you screw up. We all screw up. We all do things where it was like, holy crap, I had no idea that that would be so insulting, or that would just be the wrong thing to do. How do you handle that effectively when something pops up on social media that's negative to your brand?
So I seem to, and a lot less lately, thank the sweet bloody zombies, I seem to step into it all the time, and sometimes quite surprisingly. And So one time, here's one example of when I did it, which shouldn't have been a surprise, but it was. It was a post promoting Third Tribe marketing, and I was basically saying, you know, I charge a real lot of money for a day of my time. I charge $22,000 a day at the time of this recording, for a time of my time. So I said, you know, join Third Tribe, and it'll be like, you know, 1/127th of that price to spend time with me every month. And people hung on the $22,000 part, not the join Third Tribe offer. And one, it shows I'm a crappy marketer. Two, my God, it was some kind of crazy shot heard around the world. People were like, "Oh, you make $22,000 a day?" And I said, "No, I charge $22,000. I made that much. I wouldn't be talking to your butt."
Exactly.
I'd be having my servant who handles my lips move them towards you. I think. You know, so that went on. But then at the same time, the very next day, I put up a post saying I was looking for a couple of free interns to do some work. And in my head, what I was saying was, you know, I want to provide information and education to some interns, and I think it would be a valuable interning experience, blah, blah, blah. What everyone else said was, you cheap bastard. You know? You charge $22K and you want a free intern. See how this is going? So I had to really, really put something out there. And so let me explain how I always deal with my mistakes. And Chris Penn, who founded PodCamp with me and who's a good friend and who is, chief evil marketer at Blue Sky Factory, Chris Penn has this great line that I like to bring out all the time, which is we take Chris everywhere the second time to apologize.
That's awesome.
Because I do. I step in things all the time, and it's partly because I'm stupid and partly because I'm exploring and inventive, I'll say. I do the three A's, which I learned from restaurateuring, which I got from, I guess it has its head back in Disney. But here's the three A's. You acknowledge, you apologize, you act. So here's the three A's. Wow, I could see how this would really upset everybody. I wrote this post about charging $22,000 a day, and then I asked for free interns. I could see where that would probably ruffle some feathers. I'm really sorry that I said it that way. I had something different in my mind, and I won't really explain it because I don't want to justify anything. I just want to say that I'm sorry that I offended and upset people by talking about wanting free interns. In the future, I will be a little bit more sensitive to how I put this kind of information. So that is acknowledging that there was something wrong, but you don't necessarily even take blame for it. You just acknowledge it. You apologize for what the other person felt. And then you act, meaning you try to correct it so that it's not an issue anymore. That has served me the best in all of my social media efforts.
Yeah, because I know a lot of people will just either, you know, delete a comment or, you know, try and ignore it. And it's tough because, you know, once people... You know, not everybody talks on social media, but a lot of people lurk, you know, so to speak. They just they sit and they watch and they listen, and it's really important to kind of nip that in the bud and not let it get not let it fester and not let it kind of take root, you know, so to speak.
Yes, and by the way, let me just talk about negative comments and things like that. I have a very my policy is sort of like this. If they have a really negative comment, but it's likely that it's possibly valuable, then I leave it. If it's something just full on stupid and an attention gathering trick, or if it's something that's just, you know, far too profane, I probably will delete it and explain that I deleted it because it was that way. But for the most part, I'd rather just take on the fire, because I think that once you start messing with people's comments and once you start going that censorship route, we just have way too many examples in our space of that going wrong. I'm thinking of Dig when they tried to censor the Sony thing. I'm thinking of recently the sort of Matt Mullenweg, Chris Pearson fight, where there seemed to be a little bit of censorship going on, and people like Michael Gray, Gray Wolf, got really upset, and a lot of people did, just having that sense that Mullenweg was doing a lot of censoring on his blog comments. And I'm not casting any stones or anything in anybody's direction, because I try to be Switzerland on that sort of thing, but I would say that it's a really slippery slope once we get to censorship.
Right, and you know what the interesting thing is when somebody does leave a negative comment on their blog, and I kind of have a policy where it's like, where I do this, if your comment is negative and you're upset, then I view that as an opportunity to kind of figure out what's wrong and to talk to people about it and to just, figure out how to handle it instead of ignoring it. Now, if somebody is like absolutely just like a pure hateful comment and there's no value in it, and it's just kind of like, I think you're a blah, 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 and, you know, everything's evil, then if it's just profane and horrible, then I think it was Jonathan Fields who said, it's like your blog is your house, and if somebody came up and started spray painting stuff on your house and doing graffiti, you wouldn't stand for that. But I think that it's really interesting to come in and actually keep your cool. And I love how Brian Clark does this on Copyblogger, because I kind of learned this attitude from him. Is he steps in and he doesn't try to justify what, if somebody says, like, this post is stupid and has a terrible idea in it or something, he'll just step in and he'll explain, why something has worked in the past, or he'll be really kind of not even just diplomatic about it. He'll just kind of be just neutral about it and just show up, acknowledge, and be there for it, and not let it just be something that stands on its own and hides. And I think it's really important that we not be afraid to engage our customers on or our viewers on our blog, and realize that when we step up and we actually show up in a comment and respond to it, then as long as we keep our cool, then it allows us to keep our human face on it and say, like, look, it's okay if you disagree with me. There's nothing wrong with disagreeing with me. You're not going to be, shut out, or there's no flame war that's going to start about this. But just that you acknowledge it. You know what I mean?
Absolutely. Although it's really funny, and I'm going to toss some poop on top of Brian. I think sometimes he doesn't handle it well, and I'll say it right here. I think that sometimes Brian, just like everybody, gets sensitive and lets his emotions go first, and he jumps into the fray and says, "Oh yeah, well, you're a poopy face."
I must have missed that post.
Well,
send it to me.
interestingly, it doesn't happen as often on Copyblogger, and that's kind of where he's crazy like a fox. Don't ever doubt that. I mean, whenever Brian does something that seems a lot rash and emotional, he does tend to have a lawyer's ability to say, what are the ramifications? Which is why, he's got a nice company. I would say that, but I've seen it. I've seen him kind of go off on somebody in a post and sort of defend his turf. I guess it's not that he's rash or irrational. I would say that he gets his backup and then lets it all out onto the web in venues where he thinks that's of merit. But he does pick his fights, which is important to me.
Yeah, he can't fight every battle, and they're not always all good to fight. And I'm really glad that you mentioned that, because I want everybody who's listening to realize what just happened here. Now, for people who don't know that much about Chris or Brian, they work together in the Third Tribe marketing site that if you're a reader of any of the typical internet marketing blogs, you might have heard of already. But what's interesting is that just notice that Chris is just talking about Brian like a regular person, because we actually are all regular people. And it's easy for something that kind of reduces trust is when you put people on this pedestal and you think, oh, this is a big person, so they must not have the same issues that I have, or they're perfect people because we only see the more polished side of them sometimes, or it's just the level of success they have that creates this wow, they're not like me type of thing. But it's important to understand that part of building trust is just being a regular person even around other people. So I just thought that was really neat how on this call you're seeing an example of Chris being like, well, let me talk about Brian a little more here. Because you know that if Brian hears this, he's going to be comfortable with that, because he's got that relationship where when you build an audience of trusted people, when you build people who like you because you're a level of transparency that and I don't mean like you're telling people everything that's going on in your life. I mean, you're just honest about things and about, what's going on under the hood, that you can build an audience that doesn't expect you to be perfect. And that's, I think that's really important when it comes to trust. And I'm not trying to monopolize the interview here, but I think it's so important to create an atmosphere where it's okay for you to be imperfect. And it's okay for you to say, you know what, I mess up, you mess up. Let's talk about it as an example maybe, and just acknowledge it and move on, and not try and be shiny, because it is incredibly difficult to maintain a brand where you're perfect, because when you're perfect, everybody tries to take pot shots at you. But when you're like, oh yeah, I'm a screw up at times, then it's like it actually takes a lot of that negative publicity that could happen and kind of makes it so it doesn't even stick. You know, if somebody came up to me and said, oh, you know, you're flaky or something, Dave, or you know, you didn't get something out on time, I'm like, yeah, you know what? I do. I am late on a bunch of things sometimes, but I always get them done. And if you're connected to your audience and you're actually giving them value and treating them right, then what's interesting is actually how your audience kind of comes to your defense when things happen. I don't know if you've had to handle that on your blog, Brian. Chris, when somebody has brought up a negative thing and then other people actually chime in before you even get a chance and defend you. Has that happened to you?
Oh yeah, and believe me, I can't tell you the amount of times where I've been so excited, and I'll tell you that I've also used that power for evil a couple times. And when I say that, there are days. I just want to circle back really quickly to your
Sure.
observation and be a little add a little meta on top of that as well. That it's important to point out that we all have humanity in us, and we all have flaws. And I mean, I could tell you my flaws all day. In fact, I'm evidently I over. Explain my flaws, I'm told. So, one of the interesting things is that sometimes, you know, I get my dander up and I get frustrated. And I've been working really hard on learning how not to do that because I've just run into situations where it doesn't benefit me to, you know, get in a hissy fit. But every now and again, I will. And my gosh, what a difference when I can sic my legions of devoted fans on somebody and be like, this guy's a poopy face. And the next thing you know, they'll fill his comments up with, oh yeah. And it always looks better. You know, like for example, you know, just tell everybody that Apple sucks and you'll have 500 more comments than you did the day before. But I'll say this too. It's a power to use wisely, and it's sort of important to understand that putting a little bit of friction into the story helps with the sycophantism. Brian and I are co-founders of the Third Tribe Marketing thing, along with Sonia Simone and Darren Rouse. So if I always spoke glowingly about Brian, you'd be like, yeah, well, that's because you work with him and you're not going to say anything bad. You know, so sort of crapping on each other a little bit is also a way of saying, you know, we all recognize that we have our flaws. You know, Brian, you know, frequently points out that I am 2 years behind him in all of my business pursuits.
Yeah, it's good to have some rivalries within people too, because it, you know, it actually it creates entertainment,
Yes.
and you just strictly from even like a marketing perspective, it creates an engaging and entertaining story. I ended up doing that with somebody I'm working with on a project last night on Twitter. You know, I said something, he kind of was snarky back at me, and then I just kind of unloaded on him. But it was all fun. But you know, it's the nice thing about new media is that. You know, you don't have to be like, you know, the CEO of Coke talking to the CEO of Procter and Gamble. You know, they're not going to sit there and crack on each other because their brands and their industry don't support that. But the great thing about new media and, you know, the social side of it is that people not only accept that, but they actually crave it.
Right, I agree. And I think that, you know, it's really fun when you can do it well and when you can do it with somebody that you really respect. And, you know, when it's not just a show, because I mean, I do sometimes get frustrated. For example, Jason Calacanis. I think Jason's a really, really smart guy. But I feel like he's always on. So even when he's sort of throwing somebody under the bus, a lot of times he's doing it for stage. Do you know what I mean? So I think that it's important to do it with a level of respect and also to do it with a level of sincerity.
And like any tactic, if you use it too much, then it becomes kind of gimmicky and it becomes a staple and it loses its effectiveness. But yeah, it's nice, especially when you're working with people. It's good to let a little steam off now and then. It takes the edge off. One thing I just kind of want to pop back to kind of more of a nuts and bolts part of the interview is you've mentioned a topic called setting up listening stations before, and I know that for big businesses that you work with, the really larger companies, there are expensive and involved ways of creating, you know, a team that's going to be listening on the web and listening on social for that kind of stuff. But for smaller businesses who are either solopreneurs or small team, how do smaller businesses set up listening stations to kind of keep the pulse of what their brand is doing on the web?
So to make this really simple, I wrote one blog post that I try to point people to. So if you just Google the phrase grow bigger ears, I talk about how to set up a free listening station. I use, for example, for the free stuff, I use a mix of free and paid tools for my clients and otherwise. And I do something as simple as set up a whole bunch of searches inside of Google blog search, inside of Twitter search, inside of some other search engines on certain topics, on certain things that matter to me, on my own name, on trust agents, etc. And they all feed into Google Reader as RSS feeds. So one of the first things I do every morning is read a folder inside of Google Reader called Me. And inside of Me is stuff that people are talking about. So I actually already did it this morning, but in the last little while, people are talking about the, let's see, somebody mentioned me in a post because I mentioned them in a post. Somebody else pointed to my post about Blog World. And there's three other things where it's just kind of links to older posts. So a couple things happen when I do this. One is I make sure that somebody is not frustrated with me and that I can't go and just be helpful to them. Another is that I can find out if someone is saying great things about me and I want to go and thank them for that. And then third is when I start putting this kind of tool set to work on business problems or business opportunities, I start doing things. Like, for example, when I want to find speaking gigs, it's amazing how many I find through Google blog search, through Twitter search, et cetera, looking for things like call for papers, which I always just send them a copy of the Boston Globe.
Because, hey, they asked for it.
That's right. So, I mean, that's what I do with listening stations. Now, I listen at least 25% of every day. I use my listening tools 25% of every day. I use them for business and revenue. I do those for reputation management and all that. There's free stuff like Google Reader. There's sort of low expense stuff like Tracker, Andy Beal's thing, T-R-A-C-K-U-R. And then there's, you know, slightly more expensive things like Radian 6, Sysomos, Scout Labs, another 100 or so. And then I'm working with SAS on huge business versions of these tools called the Social Media Analytics Tool. And that's for like the enterprise types.
Yeah, I saw you had an interview at SAS. SAS is like, you know, 20 minutes away from me.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I looked at that and I was like, oh, that's awesome, because SAS is just such a cool company. They, for anyone who doesn't know about them, they're the guy who started it hated working for corporate things and, you know, decided he wanted to start a company where everything was fun. Like, the people there work 35 hours a week instead of 40 so they could go home. Managers have to do regular jobs for a certain number of hours a week to stay on the pulse. Like, they had big bowls of M&Ms sitting out and free soda machines, all these fun little things. So it's they have like a 2% turnover rate per year. It's like nobody ever leaves. So.
Right. It's rated, I think it was Fortune or Forbes magazine, or one of them rated it one of the top places to work in 2010. And I have to tell you, I stole one of their employees. I stole a guy named Dave, Dave Thomas, who's not Dave Thomas, founder of Wendy's, but another Thomas. And I stole him. So now he works with us at Marketing Labs. So think about that. I stole a guy out of the hardest place in the world to work for.
Maybe I need to try to slip back in there, because I tried to get in there a long time ago, and, you know, they didn't want people who didn't finish college. So I gate jumped and I started my own thing. I made my own rules.
And you have all the M&Ms you want?
I do. There's a bag of them in the island in the kitchen that my wife is making me stay away from because I'm trying to lose the gut. But so here's an interesting question here. Going back to the listening stations, how do you keep that from swallowing up all your time?
So I use timers a lot. I use real live egg timers, like old fashioned tick 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 from the kitchen timers, and I use online versions of that. And I have like, I went to IKEA to buy some furniture for my office, and I bought like this really old-fashioned retro-looking alarm clock with two bells on the top and a hammer in between them, you know, like serious hardware here. And, you know, so I do that because, I mean, I think we can fall into a well. The other thing is I have these, like I mentioned earlier, I have these big giant 3M posters on the wall, and I've written things on them. And part of it is to remind myself that I'm in the business to make money, not to respond to every comment. So I need to kind of keep myself focused on my business and be both in and on my work. Mm-hmm. And so I have a lot of visual cues because I'm not that smart, Dave, and I need lots of help in keeping myself out of that trench.
I understand. I've got the these huge index cards taped all over my monitor. One of them says, you know, keep working. Another one says, get ahead. And the other one says, focus, because, yeah, we need tools to kind of keep us in there. So I know we're getting towards the end of the call, so I just kind of wanted to throw this question in. How do you actually measure the return on investment personally for social media, make sure it's working for you? And I don't mean from like a Fortune 100 state. I'm talking about like for somebody who is just a regular entrepreneur, has their own smaller business, might even be a solopreneur. How do you know when your social media stuff is actually paying off for you?
So I have, it's interesting. I wrote about this in a very different way the other day. I wrote a post called Looking for Work, wherein which I used this comment where I said, there's a difference. You have to do both gathering nuts and berries and planting seeds for the next farm. And so what I mean is you can't sit around making investments in the future because your family has to eat today. So I do that sort of with my metrics as well. I have sort of three buckets of metrics. I have sales. Did I or didn't I make money? And remember, I don't make money on my blog primarily, although it's really funny. There was that copy blogger post that said that none of us in Third Tribe make money off our blog.
Mm-hmm.
But the real point was that's not our primary source of income.
Right.
And you don't know how many times I've seen that requoted on other blogs saying, Chris Brogan doesn't make any money on this blog. And it's like, it's so hard not to be like, dude, I made like $5,000 on one of my programs alone last month. You know, I feel like saying, you know, I make plenty of money on my blog, just not my primary money. Anyway, tangent. As this wrap is winding down, it's okay, three buckets. So one of them is sales. And that means, did I get professional speaking gigs? Did I get consulting gigs for new marketing labs? Did I get new people to buy into the Human Business Works idea? That's one. Number two is coverage. Because attention and awareness and reputation matter. So I do look for, did somebody find something useful enough that they wrote about it, that they visited it, that they bookmarked it, and I track things like that. I want coverage. I do not consider comments a good measure. I don't care how many Twitter followers I have, although the more you have, then of course the more opportunity a story has to spread. So I try to do things to be positive to Twitter followers, but I've grown totally organically. I'm not one of these people that, you know, had 40,000 one day and then had 850,000 the next. I won't name names. but I will say that, you know, my goals are – my metrics in social media are very, very old school. They're very much like money, humans, and coverage. And the reason is because I think that most of the metrics that people end up looking at are like things like comments are ridiculous. I mean, my kids can't eat comments. I've tried. my daughter this morning, I served her a big bowl of comments, and that was the deal.
Yeah, you got to pay the rent. Okay. Well, it's good to know. One last question I just want to throw out here right now is what do you think and this is like one of these loaded, stupid questions. What do you think the number one thing that you wish everybody who is on social media would just finally get right now?
That it's so much better to talk about other people than to talk about yourself. If you look at the people that are sort of top of game in social media, barring a very small few who somehow magically are funnier because they only talk about themselves, you'll find that most of the people who are doing it well are doing it by talking about other people way more than they talk about themselves and promoting other people. And I think it's one of those things that it's so counterintuitive and just goes against how hungry we are to get our message out that it's the thing people don't run for.
Excellent. Well, Chris, I totally appreciate the time that you have given us. You've given us a whole hour. I hope you're not going to send me a bill for 22,000 divided by, you know, eight. I really hope you don't. if so, I'll forward it to Brian. But for everyone who's listening, the page you downloaded this interview from, or if you're listening to it right on this page, there's links to everything for Chris, his Twitter account, his blog, his resources. Go ahead and check him out and hop on Twitter right now and say, you know, I really enjoyed your interview. Or maybe even just say something mean about Brian or something. And just let him know that you appreciate the stuff that he's given us on this call. Chris, thank you for your time, and I'm so happy that you're part of this project.
You're a hero to me, Dave. Thank you.
Thanks.